Good morning, everybody. The chairperson is in another meeting at the moment, and he doesn't know what time he'll be done, so we're going to start the meeting, and we'll elect a chairperson from the members that are here. Is there any nomination for chairperson? Ms. Maluleke?
I nominate Honorable Maswando to chair for us.
Mr. Masondo was nominated. Is there any seconder? Mr. Matsepe second the proposal. Is there any other proposals? Mr. Masondo, can you take the chair, please?
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. I guess there's one item on the agenda, and that agenda item is stakeholder engagement and the customary initiation bill. But for the purpose of just ensuring that this meeting is run smoothly, we may have to look at briefly at apologies. So the agenda, broadly spelled out, will be as follows. It's opening and welcome, which has just been done. And then we must look at apologies very briefly. And then three will be an input from SAPS. That will be followed later on by the Department of Health and the Department of Women in the presidency. I'm told the NPA is also supposed to be here. They're here, and that's why. Members, are we happy with that agenda? That broad outline, the agenda. Can we just have that being formally moved? Adoption of the agenda. Move by seconder.
Thank you, Chairperson. I move that we adopt the agenda as it is.
That has been moved. Any seconder? Second, Makotsipe. Thank you very much. Having opened the meeting and welcomed everybody, let's see if there are apologies.
Morning, these apologies from Mr. Ngwezi and Mr. Kalisa. They won't be able to make the meeting. Chairperson also filed a center letter to say they won't be able to make presentation to the committee today due to previous scheduled commitments, and they do request that they will be allowed to forward a written submission on the bill. Also, COSATU sent us a submission. They also had the Finance Committee this morning, so they said if they make it, if they finish early that side, they'll try to make it aside, but they do want us to consider the written submission. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I guess we should then move on to the information that has just been articulated, properly captured in the minutes. So the team at the back there will assist us just to do that. But having done so, we'll then move on to a presentation. I've seen a presentation here from SAPS. Let's use that as the guide. and then we'll engage the issues soon after presentation. We'll follow the same procedure in relation to everybody who's here.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. My name is Brigadier van der Walt. I'm with the South African Police Service Legal Services, and I have some colleagues.
Maybe we should start with that. That would be very useful. Introductions. Just introduce the team. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. I have Colonel Kevin Stein here on my right hand. He's our parliamentary liaison officer, and I will request my colleagues to introduce themselves.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. I'm Brigadier Phil Mokolwane from the Division Visible Policing.
Good morning, Chair. Honourable Members. Colonel Marakalla from Division Visible Policing.
Morning, Chair. Morning, Honourable Members. I'm Colonel Brenda Murudile from Corporate Communication National Head Office.
Introduce yourself. Okay. Oh. That's fine. But can we have just someone announce you? Just doing a list, short list, on a piece of paper, and then we'll pass it on to the team at the back. We'll try and do that. My name is Amos. My name is Masondo. M-A-S-O-N-D-O. I'm a member of the committee. I'll ask members to introduce themselves. We'll do this only once now. We won't repeat it later on.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, everybody. I'm Joyce Maluleke, member of this committee. Chairperson, I'm just concerned. I think the committee and the subs, we are not doing well in terms of gender. I see one female, and this side also it's only one female.
Ah.
We must just transform.
Yeah. We're not the point there.
good morning, Chair. My name is Joseph Chablane Dube. I'm also a member of the committee.
Morning. My name is Enoch Muzintetwa. I'm a member of this committee.
Morning. My name is Cholani David Matsepe, a member of this committee.
Good morning. Kevin Martin, member of
this. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's please proceed. The other people will introduce themselves. Maybe we should just do that. Please indicate who you are at the back. The otherwise, from COCTA, the committee, we have three people. Just introduce everybody.
I'm Shereen Kasim, the committee secretary. We have Mr. Andile Sukamani, the researcher, and Ms. Masabata Shuping. He's the researcher also from the ANC.
Okay. Let's go that way. Yes, start with you.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Nod Moiti. I'm the PLO to Diemba Bella.
Okay. Good morning, Members. My name is Monica Mutiwi. I'm from the Department of Traditional Affairs.
Morning, Honourable Members. Clifford Mohajani, Department of Traditional Affairs, Parliamentary and Cabinet Support.
Morning, Chair and Honourable Members. Rinaldi Besser, responsible for policy and legislation in Traditional Affairs.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Loy, Dainan Loy Kistunal from the National Department of Health. I'm here in the capacity of the Program Manager for Medical Male Circumcision.
The back.
Morning, Honourable Members.
I can't hear you. Please stand and project your voice.
Morning, everyone. I'm Pumlani Diamond from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Pili Lenduli. I'm responsible for governance at the Department of Women. Thanks.
All right. Please speak up, ma'am, speak up, or stand up a bit. Thank you very much. Let's proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I just want to say that it's an honor for the SAPS to appear before this committee and to make presentations on behalf of the SAPS. The presentation will be split into two portions, firstly an introduction and then secondly comments on the bill itself. In terms of the introduction, Chair, this bill that is before the committee is really the product of a consultative process between the department as well as other role players, and during October 2016, representatives of the SAPS and COCTA engaged on the bill, and during which the SAPS also had the opportunity to make some comments on the bill. And it is noted that some of those inputs are reflected in the bill. And we must state that SAP supports the principles contained in the bill as well as its objects. We think that this type of framework will make the current system of initiation much more manageable and will also assist the SAPS. So the comments that we are making are with a view to improve the bill. There are basically two major comments, and then the rest of these comments merely relate to a drafting style, and I'm sure the department will, during the clause-by-clause deliberations, bring the attention of the committee to that. The first comment that we feel that is quite important is in the bill there's a different definition of abduction, and it is proposed that that definition be removed from the bill, as the current South African law does not make provision for that definition. When in South African law reference is made to abduction, it relates to specific instances where a child is removed for purposes of sexual intercourse or to marry a child. And the definition in the bill differs somewhat from that. Where we look at the unlawful removal of a person against his or her will, that constitutes the offense of kidnapping, a definition that is also contained in Clause 1 and which will be sufficient for purposes of this bill. Chair, on Clause 4, the following comments, and these mostly relate to drafting style, and I'm sure that the committee will be alerted to that when the department does the clause-by-clause deliberations. But the number of representatives on the committee is addressed in Clause 4. We propose that it rather be addressed in regulations, as the need to expand or minimize the committee may change over time. There may be some role players that need to be added, and there may also be some role players that may have to disappear from the committee. Regulations are normally amended in a shorter time period than primary legislation, and when these operational circumstances require that people be added to committee, or when people fall away, that will just make the process a bit more speedily. Similarly, with clauses 8 and 9, there are procedural matters that could be determined in clause 8 by the committee itself, the NIOC, that's in the bill. Clause 9, that provides for biannual reports. We also propose that subclause 2 of clause 9 provides for biannual reports, but that the procedural aspects be addressed in regulations, so that the bill says what must be done and the regulations say how it must be done. It was also proposed that the details referred to in Clause 9.3 be captured in the regulations. Similarly, Clauses 10, 11, and 14, Chair, these are also clauses where some of the information that is detailed be proposed that that be captured in regulations, or in the case of Clause 14, that the procedural matters pertaining to the meetings of the PICC be determined by the committee itself. Similarly, Clause 15, the proposal is made that the provisions of Clause 15.2 could also be dealt with in regulations. Then, Clause 15.10a refers to a process to be determined by the PICC in cases where misconduct is investigated by the PICC. It is proposed that it should be made clear in Clause 15.10a that any criminal conduct should be reported to the SAPS if that investigation reveals criminal conduct. Clause 16, once again, the proposal is that the composition of the technical support teams be addressed in the regulations. Then Clause 25, Honourable Chair, this clause causes some concern with SAPS. The bill does not provide for a procedure after an initiation school has been closed in terms of that clause, 25.2c. And it could provide a practical concern as there may be medical treatment, transport of people who are injured, where that may be necessary. And just to demonstrate the practical issue is where one of these initiates is injured severely and the police transport that victim to a hospital. The victim dies during that process. That kicks off a whole investigation by our independent police investigative directorate. Because technically it's a death in custody. And we feel that the correct medical attention should rather be given to any injured people on the scene, and also that the correct mode of transport where these victims can get the necessary medical attention from the initiation school to the hospital just be provided for in Clause 25. Then when we look at Clause 25.1a, it regulates the procedure when a docket is opened and submitted to the NPA. The procedures dealt with in that clause are well established, and we feel that it may be unnecessary to provide for this in the bill. It doesn't do any harm there either. But the provision should merely provide that the SAPS must investigate the complaint. And this same comment will apply in respect of other similar provisions in Clause 25. Chair and Honourable Members, with regard to Clause 28.3a, it's just a technical issue, and I'm sure the drafting team of the department will address that. In Clause 28.3a, the reference to a person should be replaced with a reference to a child, because that specific age group are children. Also in Clause 28, the reference to the general regulations regarding children of the Children's Act is superfluous because the clause also refers to the Children's Act, which includes those regulations in any event. And then also in Clause 28 sub 10, there is an offence created there, which is superfluous in view of the provision dealing with those offences, Clause 33.2. And once again, we are quite confident that the drafting team of the department will address that situation. When we get to Clause 30, Honourable Chair, the reference to Section 10(1) of the Liquor Act as contained in Clause 30 sub 4 is an unnecessary repetition of a provision of other legislation. The danger when such provision is repeated is that, for instance, in this case, the Liquor Act could be amended for some or other reason, and then you sit with the risk that the provision contained in this bill will not also be amended to get in line with the Liquor Act. So a mere reference is often more useful than a repeat of the provision in the other legislation. The same principle applies in respect of the repetition of provisions of the Children's Act, but once again, I'm confident that the drafting team of the department will address the committee on that and to deal with that matter. Then lastly, Chair, Clause 32, the SAPS is also of the view that the matters contained in this clause is detailed and could rather be addressed by means of regulations. In conclusion, Chair, the support of the SAPS for this bill cannot be underestimated. We really need also, we also need something like this to be developed into legislation. So we thank the committee, the chair, for the opportunity to provide inputs on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anything else that the team would like to add before we open up for discussion? No? Okay. Thank you very much. Let's then proceed. By looking at it section by section very quickly. Firstly, is the support, the indication of support for the bill by the SAPS team. I'm sure we can pass that. They do say that the comments that they're making are really meant to improve the bill rather than anything else. They pointed amongst others the question of the drafting style. The third point that is being raised there is the definition of abduction, and that arises on page 7 of the slide. Are there any comments that anyone would like to make on that? Yes. I'm sure a good doctor at the back there is noting the points, but we'll come back to you later. Are there comments from the members of the committee? Dube.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. My question, I just want to get a clarity on close 30.
I thought you were going to go step by step.
Oh, okay. No,
we're now on page 7.
No, I'll come back. Okay.
Any comment on slide 7? They've just clarified the question of abduction.
Let me check, Chair, on the subs that in terms of this adoption, do you have any cases currently that are in your position raising from this issue of adoption? Are there any people that have been charged up to so far that you know of? So that we, before removing the issue of adoption, we also understand the difficulties that this area is giving you some problems.
Thank you, Chair. We do have this problem about abducting kids. It occurs predominantly during the winter initiation period. And presently, it happens across provinces where kids are taken from, for example, Gauteng into Mpumalanga and on Mpumalanga and Limpopo. So it does happen. We do have that. Unfortunately, we don't have the stats of the cases that have been reported, but we do have that complaint that it recurs almost every time during winter initiation period.
Thank you, Shepard. I'm just thinking for Honorable Mteta. We have a problem with the word abduction. This is kidnapping. So what he wanted to check is if maybe the parent opens a case to say so-and-so has abducted my kid to the initiation school. Is that case winnable or not because of this weight abduction? I think that's what Honorable Mteta wanted to find clarity on.
Yes, Chairperson, thank you. Yes, there is some confusion. I have to agree with the Honorable Maluleke. It happens at station level also. But normally when that docket comes to the National Prosecuting Authority, the correct charges will be drafted. And in the event that a child is abducted for purposes of sexual intercourse, the docket will reflect those charges. And normally in the cases that this bill is trying to deal with, the docket will reflect the charge of kidnapping.
Thanks, Jefferson. Perhaps just to latch on to the Honorable Marieke's question. When we look at the notion of abduction and initiation, it will be different for boys and girls, and the reasons for their kidnapping will be different. For girls, mainly because of the overarching context of patriarchy that we live in, most initiation practices are geared around sexuality. So, for example, FGM, the sowing of a girl's libido, would be for the sexual satisfaction of a man. And even virginity testing will be to ensure that girls are pure at the age of marriage. So the question then I would ask through you, Chairperson, is to what extent can we use the word abduction in relation to initiation practices that are geared towards girls, taking into consideration that many, not all, but many of these initiation practices have been perverse around sexuality. Thanks.
This issue of abduction. You see, the problem here is that indeed these children are being abducted. But then, the minute they get to the venue, they are told that if you tell parents that you were abducted, then we are going to kill you here. So how do you actually, get deeper in terms of interrogating the child as to whether indeed he was or he came by himself to be circumcised? Because quite often, the proof would be if the mother comes and says, so and so saw such and such a person abducting my child, or I've seen the person myself, then you will be in the position as a police to say that indeed this was an abduction case. But
if the mother says, I don't see my child, and then you make a follow-up, you get to this mountain, you find that the child is there. How do you actually get the real thing there? Because the children are quite, you know, we have been told that if you say that you have been abducted, you must say that you came here by yourself. Now, how do you ascertain as to the authenticity of the allegation?
I guess, I mean, at one level, what we're trying to do is have a discussion that tries to assist with the use of the language, the words. That's why the comment from the doctor at the back there will also be useful. But as you're making your submission, the issues are automatically, I think, noted. But I don't know if the doctor at the back would like to make a comment. No, not at this stage. Can I take it that this point on the word kidnapping or whatever alternative word and so on is noted, and the team from the department will ensure that the matter is looked into, take into account comments that have been made by the members. Thank you very much. The next part is clause 8. Not unless anyone wants to make any other comment before that. Yes. Madam?
Chair, it's common practice in the bills that we pass that we try and regulate the committees through legislation in terms of minimum standards that we expect. And that happens in a number of bills that we've seen before this portfolio committee. So, for example, the traditional governance framework amendment act, where we regulate specifically who shall be on a committee, how often they shall meet, et cetera, et cetera. Those are minimum standards, and they then determine, they don't say this particular person, but they determine a class of people, for example. So, for example, in this bill, the PICC and the NICC, it says at least two members of each of these categories, which then gives a framework for the minister to then appoint people through the Government Gazette. I think that for us to throw all of that to regulation, it then requires, first of all, that those regulations be adopted, but it also is a devolution of power from Parliament. It's a delegation of power from Parliament to the Minister. And we're then saying, well, the Minister can determine who he likes to be on that committee. The Minister can determine who is going to, or how often that committee is going to meet. The committee can determine if they're going to meet at all. That's essentially what's being proposed here. And this regulation, legislation, this particular clause, sets minimum standards for how often that committee shall meet. It sets how often or how that committee shall be structured, etc. I don't think we should be referring it to to regulation.
Okay. Point noted. Yeah. Another comment on 8? I guess the point is noted. Can we go to clause 9?
Same comment.
Okay, from LM, same comment. Any other comment? No. Can we move to the next page? Page 10. Any comment on clause 10? That also refers to regulations. Can I take the same comment?
Okay, it doesn't do any harm. Let me put it like that. Having this here doesn't do any harm to the.
Okay.
But not unless, Chair, they motivate for us further and say why they felt this might contradict the other act.
Chairperson, as I said in the beginning, I think this is a matter that the committee will decide on during the clause-by-clause deliberations. It's a proposal from our side, as the composition of these committees could possibly change over a period of time, because this legislation is supposed to last for the next 100 years. The dynamic nature of our society could sometimes require that a member be added. However, I must immediately also add that from the SAP's perspective, this is a mere proposal with all the necessary respect to the drafting team, because I'm sure the drafting team had a specific objective in mind, and should the committee decide to keep these in the bill, it will only enrich the bill. We don't think it will be a problem as such.
Okay. Sorry, the comment is noted. Can we move on to page 11 of the slide? So maybe we should just say clause 11 first. The exact number of representatives, again, that's in relation to regulations. If there are no specific comments, we can pass that. Clause 14 on page 10. That professional matters pertaining to the meeting of the PICC. Be determined by the committee itself. You can recommend, no problem on that. Clause 54. Yes.
Chairperson, I think maybe we need just to appreciate the presentation by SAPS and their thinking on how we can come up with the act. But it doesn't harm us to agree on their proposal or to modify it. Because as Honorable Melham was saying, it's not the first bill that we are dealing with. These are standards that we have as we deal with our bills. So we are going to be clear to say maybe a minimum. It's not the maximum, it's the minimum. If they decide to have 15 meetings, it's up to the committee, but the minimum should be there.
Okay. Thank you very much. Clause 15, page 11. Any comment? Want to comment at the back? No comment. Thank you very much. And then clause 16 there speaks to the composition of technical support teams be addressed by regulations. Any comments there?
No. Chair, just on this one, I note that the way that the clause is worded is quite open-ended. So it says the PICC may establish a technical support team consisting of not more than two representatives each of any or all of, and then it talks about a whole list of people, and then it ends with, and any other interested body as identified by the PICC. In other words, it's a very open-ended group of people, but it says each of those can have no more than two representatives. I don't think that that's restrictive in any way or closing down the opportunity for people to form part of the PICC, of the technical support team. I do think it does allow the PICC the opportunity to create a technical support team that is targeted to a specific set of circumstances in that province or in that particular area. So if there's a need for SAPS people, for example, they could put SAPS people on there. If there's a need for medical people, their technical support team would be more medically focused and so on and so forth. I think that this particular clause is actually broad enough that it allows for that flexibility.
Okay. Clause...
My point was on that Are you aware that in other schools that people go, the number sometimes is up to 1,000 or 3,000? That's what we have learned in some of the public hearing when you're drafting this for this clause of the testing. Were you aware of that?
Honorable Mteta is saying is in the hearings that the committee has had in different provinces, there's come across a lot of information. Amongst others, for instance, the fact that the numbers could be fairly huge, 1,000 or more, as indicated. I guess that's for noting, but if there are specific things that you want to comment, that you want to raise, please do so. You don't have to. Okay. Can we move on to page 12? Clause 25 there. Practical concern, as there may be medical treatment, etc., etc. Any comment on that? On clause 25 general, not just the first part there, the second part as well. Are there specific comments that anyone wants to make? On clause 25. Let's start with yourself and then come to Melam and Mtetwa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that your point of stuff with regard to the provision section 25.1 subsection A. But it does occasionally happen that sometimes the dockets are not open for some reason or the other. So it's neither here nor there really to keep that provision in, but it does provide one. Some security to say that a docket should be open.
Okay. Yes. Any other comment? Yes, Malham, then Ted.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, just with regard to the first bullet point on the slide, and that refers particularly to section 25.2c. I hear where SAPs are coming from, but I don't know that the medical treatment, etc., is this whole section, and maybe the heading is a little bit misleading, but this whole section is talking about investigation rather than medical treatment. And I'm wondering whether or not we should maybe change the heading to say investigative processes and the like, or something under SAPS and NPA, rather than talking about that first part where we talk about, I understand that in the course of an investigation, medical treatment may become necessary, but that then would follow normal procedures that SAPS have. I just want to raise that as a flag.
Yeah, I'm sure that the board can be noted.
I also got a concern here, Chair, because also for me, the role of the SAP here is not about transport issues and also getting to the medical space. For them, for me, if you look at the bill also focuses on saying whether there is a case of adoptions or not. I wonder which role the SAP wants to play now. Because you talk about the after effect. So what role do you think in this section you want to play? So that if you may be specifically to me, I really don't understand the way you have responded here, your concern.
Yes,
thank you, Chair. Yes, the reason for the suggestion there, if I may answer the Honourable Mtetwa, is that when such a school is closed, and that is the end of the process, there may be injured people, and SAPS will be there to investigate, but not necessarily other medical assistance. And to use a crude example, we cannot arrive on the scene saying, no, sorry, we are investigating. We cannot take you to hospital even though you are injured. So in practical terms, that would require our SAPs to look at a function that is not strictly ours, but out of humanitarian purposes, we will have to assist. And if there's a provision that deals with after such a school has been closed, that, for instance, the Department of Health be involved or a medical facility be involved, that would assist also in terms of the prosecution later of that case, because there has to be a chain of evidence, and that is not always possible if the bill just stops with the school may be closed. But I'm absolutely convinced that the drafters in the department will address the committee on that.
Yes,
Chair, thank you. It's not usual for the department to respond while the committee is busy with stakeholder engagements. But on this point, just so that all members are aware, if you go to page 14 of the bill, this is clause 15, sub-clause 7. I'm not going to read what is there, but that is where the procedure is for once the school is closed. And it also deals with the health aspects there. Thanks, Chair.
Well, thank you very much. Can I move on to page 13, clause 28? Yes,
Chair, I don't agree with the first bullet point at all, because people older than the age of 18 may be attending an initiation school. And so the 28.1b.
Okay.
A person, a child, I don't know that it's here.
Okay. There's a point here. If there are no comments on clause 28, let's move on to the next page, which is page 14. Page 14 is clause 30.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Let's talk about 28. You got a point, because in other areas, again, because this public hearing has assisted us a lot, there are other people that goes there after even above 20 years old. Others, there's a process of this thing until the age of 30 or 40. So to address this and be specific about others are doing it, we learned in COPSA that they do their kids, the Greeks, at the age of 3 months. So I think here the issue, we must not be specific to say children or what. I think SAP must reconsider that area and relook at it.
The drafters should note the consent, or should have noted the consent, and we'll look into the matter. Can we look at the next page, which is page 14, clause 30?
The last bullet point is actually valid on 28. It does duplicate 33.2. 33.2 creates the offence, and 28.10 basically duplicates what's said in 33.2. So,
point is noted. I'm sure the team at the bank is looking at that. We'll look at that. Clause 30 on page 14. Children's Act, the Liquor Act, and possible confusion, and so on, yes.
Chair, I'm concerned that if we take this out of this bill, that the Liquor Act, the reason I'm concerned is that the Liquor Act is generally only enforced upon complaint. It's only really enforced by your liquor control officers in SAPS. It's not enforced by a person doing an inspection on an initiation school. And if we take it out of here, they're not going to be looking for this particular offense or problem at an initiation school. And we all know, we've heard in the public hearings, that the illegal provision of liquor and alcohol at initiation schools does sometimes create problems. I think that there needs to be a reference, but maybe we need to just say with the relevant provisions of the Liquor Act or however it needs to be drafted. But I do think that we need to point to it and say that the provision of liquor to minors is an offence in terms of the Liquor Act and must be prosecuted and followed up on.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regards to the Liquor Act, I think this recommendation was made by the NCA, myself in particular. I agree with the Honourable Member. We can perhaps just make reference to the Liquor Act without specifying the normal the section, as you said there, and that should suffice. But it has to be in there, at least a reference to the Liquor Act and the provision that it is prescribed, you know, to give children any sort of liquor, etc., at initiation school. So yes, we can refer to the Liquor Act. So it's basically just wordiness of that, a rephrasing of that particular section. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. In fact, in the hearings, in most hearings that I was privileged to be part of, this thing of liquor is frowned upon by communities in general. And the problem is identified in many instances. I guess what we should do is to, again, when you look at the phrasing and the tightening of the bill and so on, that this should be really be seriously looked into as we tighten the bill. Okay. What I'm saying is that it's not only us who see there's a problem here. It's a problem in communities as well. Can you pass this one? The team that's drafting will also look. Clause 32, that the matters contained in this clause should be assessed by means of regulations.
What Honorable Melham has said about the regulations
applies as well. Okay. I don't know if the team from SAPS wants to make any comment, final comment.
Chairperson, no, except to say that once again we support the provisions of the bill and also to thank the committee for the opportunity to make a presentation here.
Okay. Maybe we should take this opportunity then to thank the team for the presentation and wish you well as you travel back. On behalf of the committee and on behalf of the chairperson as he enters the venue, thank you very much for coming and for the presentation. As far as we're concerned here, your input will then go and assist the team as it continues to craft and fine-tune the bill. Thank you very much. Yeah, okay, please, Tuesday. Not unless you want to stay. Yes. Okay, no, that's fine. Now, we'll then move on. Thank you very much. We'll then look at the Department of Health, if the health people can step forward. Department of Health, please come to the chairs up front. Health, women, and NPA.
And we break for tea.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson and honorable members. I just want that at the outset to tell that we received this document quite late yesterday, late in the evening. But we did peruse through the document and made some broad engagements with it and some inputs, which we hope that will have the committee in strengthening the document and enriching it. So we're coming in from the health perspective in terms of ensuring that the initiates that receive services at an initiation site or a school enjoy health benefits and that they are safe and the outcomes are positive. So in the context of traditional initiation, our role is to improve the quality of life for the initiate in ensuring health standards are implemented and complied with and the circumcision is safe and has health benefits in terms of HIV, STIs, penile hygiene and cancers. Just to tell you what the prevalence of HIV amongst the population in the different provinces, and we see that we are the prevalence is creeping. And it's getting out of control, so we need to ensure that we have integration of medical circumcision within traditional initiation practice to get the full benefits of it. So I just wanted to just outline the guidelines and
we are happy to say that the document is actually kind of partially aligned to the medical male circumcision guidelines, and it takes us back in 2014 where we spoke with COCTA and other stakeholders at a meeting in Pretoria, a GCIS building, where we proposed that medical male circumcision, the minister actually play a critical role in terms of safe outcomes for these young initiates undergoing the initiation process and the circumcision procedure within the traditional setting. So what we are asking for from the traditional sector or the initiation practice is that we want these young initiates to enjoy the full benefits of HIV prevention in the future, and don't unnecessarily undergo the procedure for the second time for health benefits. And the guidelines we can share with you at some time, but the evidence is very, very strong that medical circumcision within if circumcision is done medically within the traditional practice, the initiates will enjoy the benefits of HIV prevention and STIs and penile cancers and so forth in the long term. I'm just going to quickly go through this. So how are we working within the traditional settings? We want to use TMI as part of the entry point for HIV prevention, and we recommend the guidelines within MMC, which looks at the different areas of health screening for all initiates. There must be clear referral pathways for those with medical problems. We want to encourage medical trained doctors and nurses to assist with the full surgical removal of the foreskin and wound care to enjoy the benefits of HIV prevention and other STIs. The document also speaks about counseling and informed consent, and I think it's in line with what we have in the guidelines, and also in terms of legal age of consent, and who can give consent, and which documents are required to prescribe how the consent should be given, and at what age, and so forth. In terms of health standards for the that needs to be implemented within the initiation sites of the schools, we are looking at the screening of initiates for communicable and non-communicable diseases. That's HIV, TB, taking of blood pressure, diabetes, checking for hemophilia, history taking whether the initiate is on medication, chronic medication, ARVs for HIV infection, whether there's health conditions in terms of asthma, breathing problems, detection of penile abnormalities and referral for further management. Use of equipment, instrument for initiate to prevent transmission of HIV and other diseases. Maintaining hemostasis, wound closure and wound care, and managing pain and ensuring that the wound is completely healed. So that was just kind of a broad outline of the guidelines for MMC and looking at how it is structured within this document. We found that our comments in the document is balanced. Is aligned with the constitutional prerogatives and also partially aligned to the MMC guidelines for the Department of Health. the structures and process to monitor initiation process are adequately addressed, but the document talks of surgical removal of foreskin, but it says partial or complete. And we're asking that we consider the health benefits of medical male circumcision, and ensuring that we have complete removal of the foreskin so that the initiate enjoys at some stage in the future the benefits of not contracting HIV because it is partially protective, not contracting STIs, the alternative which is called chancroid, syphilis, herpes, you must have heard of these, protection from penile cancers, and also protect the female partners from HPV infection and cervical cancers. We also look at the use of medical practitioners, and we welcome this. We applaud this because we know that in the at the initiation sites, lots of young boys lose their manhood. There's a lot of infection, there's necrosis, there's
falling of the penis, rotting of the penis, and we want to prevent this from happening. So the use of medical practitioners on site will be able to prevent these kind of occurrences and ensure good outcomes for the boys. But the question that we have is, well, who will pay for the medical practitioner to perform the procedure? And the document also speaks about use of members or practitioners who are over 40 years, and we're asking what is the rationale for the age limit. On page 7, the guiding principles, providing initial healthcare services, we're asking whose role is this? Can we delineate between responsibility between the traditional surgeon versus the medical practitioner? What are the roles? What are the clear roles? On page 9, the Department of Health and the HPCSA is cited to develop guidelines to determine whether a person is fit for initiation. We would guess that this document is in place because we are implementing the program within traditional sites, and so we should be reading from this document. The other point is due diligence in terms of collecting information on initiation demographics and consent information and vetting process of a practitioner, and liability is part of good clinical practice. And I think this is well articulated, and we really applaud this venture taken by the committee to ensure that there's transparency in what we are doing. The training of traditional surgeons and traditional health practitioners, the question is what kind or type of training is required, and we need clarity here. On page 18, where the parent or guardian to decide whether medical or traditional surgery should be done on the initiate, and giving parents power in decision making, I think is also welcome in the document, because we know that during the practice of this ritual in the mountains or in the bushes, parents are not given enough information on what's going on. They don't know what's going on. They're left in the dark. And these boys die, and eventually they don't even know about the passing of the child. So this is really lauded by the department that there should be joint decision-making in terms of whether the child or the initiate is fit for circumcision, whether we should provide medical or traditional circumcision. But the question is, what guidelines are used to decide whether we should have medical or traditional circumcision? And we need to be clear on this, because there could be lots of confusion amongst parents and the traditional community, the traditional leader or the traditional practitioner, as to what's best for the initiate. So we need clear guiding documents in terms of making these decisions under what conditions and circumstances that we should make the decisions. But overall, we think the document, we thank the committee for really working hard and coming up with a document that is fit for implementation and guiding the initiation process and ensuring that the interest of the child is first before anything else.
Thank you very much for your presentation and also the written presentation, and we'll be able then to engage on it. I think we'll be ready to come back if the committee so decides, having applied your mind, because you have indicated that you got it late yesterday.
Very, very late. It's about 10 o'clock last night.
About 10 o'clock last night. As a result of that, you may pick up other areas as you reread it again. You'll be in touch with the secretary.
Yeah.
If you may want also to revisit the committee, I think we'll be available for that. But thank you for coming. Let us take questions, colleagues, and comments. Honorable Mthethwa, Honorable Maluleke, Honorable Melhem, Honorable Matsipe.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to ask you, Doc, whether... Do you believe that would you believe that the the traditional doctors can do this type of work. I know you are looking at the at your professional level, but they also have been doing this for years, and there was an argument to say they still feel that they must continue doing it without your intervention. Do you think that is that possible with you guys, or sit at the back seat and train them how to take out the four head skills?
Yeah, we can question or do we take more questions?
Chairperson, thank you very much. And I think you said it well that because they got the document very late, that is why maybe their presentation is mostly on the prevalence of HIV and AIDS and the prevention of it, but not talking to the bill itself. And I think maybe it would be proper, really, to give them enough time to go through the document and check what is it that you can do to enrich the bill before it becomes an act. My question would be on page 13, you are saying, who's going to pay for the medical practitioner? And I would also want to ask the question, who's paying for the medical practitioner for the MMC? Because with the bill, the aim is to minimize the botched circumcision. Because we are saying in the bill, the medical practitioner should be there to guide or to oversee the traditional surgeons when they do the work, whether they are doing it correctly or not. But then if we are talking about the payment, that's where I get the problem, because now doctors are being paid to through the MMC. So why can't they also go to the mountains and assist if they need to? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just two comments. The first is, with regard to the requirement that initiates have a medical certificate before they undergo initiation, I think that there needs to be some kind of process put in place for those people who are unable to obtain a medical fitness certificate. In other words, you go to your medical practitioner to get your medical certificate. He says, this is wrong with you. You have a heart condition or whatever. But what happens then? You know, so I think that needs to be considered somewhere. And then secondly, and this is more to the department, I note that it's an offence to admit a person who doesn't have a medical certificate, but there's no offence to a person who forges a medical certificate. We've got an offence if they forge a consent form, but not a medical certificate, and I think it would be the right place to put it in there as well. Thank you, Chair.
On the ages 16 to 18, can I get reasons as to why these ages 16 and 18, and also the issue of payment? I don't think that I don't know whether it's a provincial issue or national issue, because in Limpopo early in May each May, doctors perform these sessions at the hospitals at the beginning of, just before the onset of the initiation, June, July, before that period. They get to hospitals, nearby hospitals, and these sessions are performed on them. And when they get to the mountain, they are not done anything. They are only, you know, sort of initiated into the process of manhood, that is socialization in terms of becoming a man in the future. So I don't know whether this is a provincial issue or national. Otherwise, that is what is happening in Limpopo. Honorable Mutsipe have covered me a little bit. I think the intention is not about circumcision only, but there's an initiation part of it, which I think is omitted. Now, when you will look on your content of the traditional initiation, you didn't involve the environment. You know, the water should be clean there, and the environment also should be clean. We are only concerned with the circumcision. I think what we need to do is just to note the submission or the presentation.
Then bound by the ethical rules of that particular board. And if memory serves me correctly, doctors, medical practitioners may not perform a surgical procedure out of a specific environment, I think a hospital environment. So within that context, would a medical practitioner be able to perform circumcision out in the field where you usually keep it? Does occur. That's one. And then the other thing with regards to payment, it has been noted that in Mpumalanga, for example, the chiefs would receive payment from the family of the initiate, and part of that money, where the chief has, he makes the appointment with regards to a traditional surgeon or a doctor. But it has been noted that even where the chief had appointed a medical doctor, for example, that medical doctor was actually paid in cash by the chief. So, and one would hope that insofar as medical fees go pertaining to circumcision, we would hope that that medical practitioners will do so out of the goodness of their hearts as opposed to requiring fees from poor initiates. So that is the issue. And the other thing is, with regards to strict hygiene when you're out in the field, and there are certain practices that just that or certain chiefs that will tell you, you may not cover the wound, you may not do a ring or whatever it is. How do you propose to deal with that kind of situation? Because once that initiate has been circumcised, whether it's by a traditional surgeon or by a medical practitioner, and he goes out, the living arrangements are rather informal. The possibility of picking up infections, etc., will be greater after circumcision because the body is also more susceptible to bacteria and so on and so forth. So what do you propose can be done in those circumstances? Are you proposing that medical practitioners continue to monitor all the initiates during the process, because the experience has been that medical doctors have, up until this stage, denied responsibility for an initiate. As soon as they have circumcised that initiate, they say they're no longer responsible for that initiate. So how do you intend to meet
COP has given all the provinces a blueprint as to how to go about this issue of initiation. I wanted to take up the issue of ages 16 and 18 and combine it with your question there. That in Limpopo, the standard age is 13 years in Limpopo. And Limpopo, all the initiates come back without a single death. All of them. And in this the recent initiation season, 53,000 of initiates all came back. Eastern Cape, the same period, 3-4 months back, 27 initiates died. So this is all about the issue of children being exposed to all sorts of factors, and also about the fact that there is no monitoring at all. I want I'm also challenging the issue of the age 16. That's why I said I want to know the reasons for saying ages 16 and 18. Because in Limpopo, there is a close monitoring, and medical practitioners perform this surgery, and they do the dressing of the wounds, and every second or third day they go back and check in Limpopo. So I should think that we should support the issue of 13 years, because Limpopo is an example of a province with no casualties at all. But Mpumalanga, former KwaNdebele, Eastern Cape, and elsewhere, and Gauteng. In Gauteng, people who are actually performing these things, it's a question of commercializing. It's a commercial question there. It's not a real in the issue of helping the initiates and what have you. Like with this very bill recently in Limpopo, traditional leaders just supported the bill from the very beginning and said, in fact, you are belated as government, you ought to have had this bill long ago. They are not against these issues. They've taken the lead, and that is why there are no casualties at all there in Limpopo. So we really need the issue of age. I'm also.
I think that members, we have to discuss the question of age. At the health level, they will explain. Of course, also ourselves must read the Children's Act and all those laws that are existing already that says what is the age limit for a child. And we must deal with that issue. It's a separate issue completely that we have to deal with it. I think we must allow them to answer some questions. And then when we go clause by clause, we'll come to the issue of age and how do we deal with this issue that we are raising. And, okay. Yes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for all that, and lady, for that question. I just want to say that we are not contesting traditional initiation, but we want to make the circumcision much, much more safer, and it has health benefits and HIV prevention, because our program, Medical Milk, is an HIV prevention intervention. So do we need the first one, Honorable Mtetwa? Sorry, I must have forgotten some of your names, so I wasn't part of the committee, so forgive me for that. Do we need traditional surgeons? So we're not questioning the role of traditional surgeons. We know from ecological studies and social science studies that circumcision has contributed towards reduction of HIV infections. We know that. And therefore, there was the randomized control trials that were done to prove that. They've made an hypothesis from that to say that this is protective. And when they did the RCTs in three different countries, they found that circumcision is probably, if it's done like this, and if you follow the procedure and the protocols until the wound is completely healed, you'll get the full benefits of that. So we need the traditional surgeons because they are part of that initiation process. But we're asking that we find a way or mechanism of how best to deal with the full removal of the foreskin and ensure that there's hemostasis, you know, that the client doesn't die of bleeding, unnecessary bleeding, infections, and there's good wound healing. So we need the traditional surgeon to work with a medical practitioner, hands in glove, so that there's good outcomes for the initiate. And the other question, who pays for medical practitioner? So somewhere in the document, I read it last night, it says that the minister he has the power, or he or she has the power to prescribe a fee for the procedure, or for the fee for the traditional surgeon or the traditional leader or the traditional practitioner. And with we see them, there might be some problem with the traditional practitioner or the traditional surgeon being there and the medical practitioner being there. So we mustn't see that there's competition between the medical practitioner and the traditional surgeon to make one feel inferior, the other feel superior. There should be a hands-in-glove working environment between these two these individuals. And we don't want the traditional surgeon to feel like that, you know, the money that's been taken by the chief now is paying the medical practitioner at the account of the traditional surgeon. So we want to find a way of how best we can deal with these payments. It's also difficult for us to pay a doctor or a traditional medical practitioner if they're not registered with us as part of the program and the province, because you need to procure the services. And somewhere in the document it also states that parents can buy the services of a medical practitioner and take them to the initiation site and say, I want you to circumcise, I want you to circumcise my child. So how do we deal with those? Because now it becomes like a private matter where the parent now buys the services of the medical practitioners, take to the site, and who's going to pay for that? If they cannot afford it, what happens then? We don't circumcise that child because now we have a problem. There's medical versus traditional. So we have to consider those factors and how best we manage them. The other question was, let me go to the next one. About forging, you spoke of the forging of the medical certificate. So it's really a difficult one. You need someone to investigate that, to come to tell that this is a fraudulent document, and you need a process for that to unravel what's the real truth behind that. So it makes it difficult. And we're having the same thing within the MMC program, where we get an outside assignment on behalf of the parent taking consent. So we're now asking that the parent comes to the facility with the child for circumcision, so we have the ID document of the child and the parent, the guardian, to ensure that the consent is authentic and there's no fraudulent activity. The other one is, sorry sir, the 16 to 18, our age group for circumcision is 10 to 49. All males that are eligible for circumcision is from 10 years. The minister wants us to circumcise from as early as 10 years, because we know that our young children are engaging in early sexual debut, and they are at risk of STIs and including HIV with this spicy mom syndrome or whatever they call it, you know, because they're engaging in sex with even older women. So we want to ensure that they are protected from an early age, and we want to invest for the future so that they're not dying at an early age from HIV infection and having all the things that go with HIV infection. So I know in Limpopo you have a very good model. I think we need to replicate this model in other provinces, but we know that the implementation of traditional initiation in other provinces are different. You can get so many hundred different traditional schools with different protocols and so forth. So we need to be cognizant of that. You know, but your model works well because the children go to the doctor, they get a clean bill of health, they get circumcised at the hospital, so we are paying for the circumcisions because National Treasury gave us money for the program that we transfer to the provinces for the program. So when they go to the mountains, they're already circumcised, they continue with the initiation process. That's really great. We applaud you for that. We really appreciate that. And we're also getting our numbers for monitoring and evaluation and for reporting to a cabinet. But we know that in some provinces where these children are circumcised, when they go back to initiation school, there's a backlash from them where they're recircumcised. I don't know what recircumcision means, but they kind of cut them again. As punitive action, that you shouldn't have went for medical because you should come for traditional, because now you are choosing medical over traditional. So we need to really try and see how best we can manage those difficulties that are encountered by those young boys, especially in the Eastern Cape Province. There was a question about why didn't we talk about environment issues, water and nutrition and so forth. We are providing, as a department, provinces with funding to ensure that there's clean water, there's catering, and there's also emergency medical responses if there's amputations or adverse events during the circumcision procedure. But we are concentrating more on where the real problem happens. We know that you can social development can provide water. They can also provide catering and nutrition for these young boys. But if you look at statistics, the injury occurs when the circumcision is done. If it is not done according to the standards, if that surgeon is not well-trained or well-versed in the procedure, you can pick up infections which can later turn to necrosis, and that young child losing the manhood. So we're trying to engage in the area where we can make a difference in terms of outcomes for the child, in terms of growing up into a lively individual without complications and other things. So we're not only concerned about circumcision, but we just wanted to just tell you that we are worried about, but we are providing finances for the other aspects that deals with other social determinants.
I just need to understand something. How long does medical male circumcision take? Is it like 15 minutes? Is it an hour? Is it 2 hours? And if it's a relatively short process, what prevents the department from putting resources where the initiation schools are taking place? Because this bill
asks that all those initiation schools be registered, so we know where they are and when they are. Now, if you could have a mobile clinic with a surgeon that goes to the location that the initiation school is taking place in, and deals with 15 boys or 10 boys or however many it is, and sorts it out, it would make it so much easier to then get it done. So I just need an understanding. Is it a lengthy process? Is it quite a short process? And what's preventing us from providing the resources to do that?
No, it's very short. It's about 20 minutes, maybe 15. If a practitioner is very adept, it's about 15 minutes. The problem is buying from the traditional sector and the traditional leader. And also the competition between the traditional surgeon now and the medical practitioner. So it's like, I think it's also a bread and butter issue also, you know, because you're taking away our income and our practice and so forth. So we need to be very careful how we tend to. But I think your idea is a very good model of integration of medical into traditional initiation. We will prevent a lot of those unwanted adverse events if we really could. We are ready to do that. We have the resources. We have doctors. We have mobile clinics. We have all the commodities and accessories. We have everything. We just need the traditional leader to invite us, and we are there. We'll provide the circumcisions for them. And of course, you know, these children are our children. It's our numbers also, because we have very high targets. And the sign says that if you do high volume of circumcision within a short period of time, you get a bigger impact on the epidemic. And we are showing that MMC now has prevented over 100,000 HIV infections by implementing the program. So it is working, and it will get even stronger as we move forward, but we need to get a win-win situation between ourselves and the traditional sector. But Minister Mosideri even mentioned in 2014 that if you can please allow us to bring a traditional practitioner, we will pay for it from the traditional grants, from Treasury. The circumcision, we will do the circumcision, we'll check for hemostasis, suturing, ensure that the wound is completely healed, and you can take over the initiation process. So we're not interfering with the initiation process, but we just want to help with the circumcision, just one part of the initiation process.
Okay, no, that's fine, and I think Honorable Masip, we are raising some points. That's one of the reasons why there's no death in the northern province is precisely because the circumcision is done by medical doctors, and the initiation then is Nyambos and Tetwa's thing. Is an issue that we have to look at it, and I agree that unless traditional leaders and traditional people also changes the way they look at this thing, we should find a way systematically of convincing them how to do that. Because the last thing you do is just circumcision. It shouldn't be an issue under normal circumstances. Then initiation, then families can take care of that thing.
Yeah.
It shouldn't necessarily cause havoc to any situation like that. But you know the social impact and some problems in many families and many villages about these issues. It's something that I think in Limpopo they've been addressed, they've addressed it. I think they've modernized it completely. And in other areas, I think they'll follow as time goes on. And then how we work together with the Department of Health then would assist us to address some of these challenges. Because once it's accepted in one part of the country, it will also be accepted in other provinces that are not doing it. And I think the case that then is almost Limpopo one, it's just circumcision. Nothing else, hospitals, the clinics are there. I think they're well provided anyway.
Yes.
They deal with this thing far better. And then there's no death and other issues there. I think we have to deal with it a little bit at the social aspect of it, because that's the only issue really that is causing some problems. I think we should proceed, and thank you very much for presenting to us. You're going to consider the proposal that we are putting forward. And of course, because we are a department, from time to time we'll invite you to ensure that the bill that we are proposing becomes a bill general that covers what you as a department also think should be covered on that. Okay, thank you very much
for
your presentation. Okay. Can we move to MPA
there's a Department of Women's Rights, they'll be the last one. No, you can come closer if you want to come closer. You want to, now, you want to use the slides?
Thank you kindly, Mr. Chair. Honourable members, attendees, I've been attending to initiation matters since the 30 deaths that we've had in Mpumalanga in 2013. And the first thing we noticed when it came to the 30 deaths in Mpumalanga were, as the one honourable member wanted to find out, how long does a circumcision take? There were instances in where 100 initiates were circumcised within the space of 2 hours. The circumstances under which those circumcisions occurred were in the early hours of the morning, about 4 or 5 o'clock, till about, say, 10 o'clock, depending on how many people were being circumcised. The circumstances under which the circumcisions were being conducted there were in darkness. Sometimes the generators were not working. The people performing the circumcisions were very elderly and had issues with sight, but were performing surgical procedures. The issue also was that there was no follow-up by the circumciser on the initiates. Absolutely no follow-up. The viewpoint is, or was, that the circumciser is no longer responsible. Once the circumcision is done, if he's satisfied and the family is satisfied that the circumcision was done correctly, that's the end of the circumciser's role in all of this. We are advised that in amongst the Kwa and Bele in particular, the persons who circumcise, the traditional surgeons, normally have to go and perform some kind of ritual after the circumcision, and therefore they're not available to follow up. So that is why I was also concerned about the issues that we have. The provision here would say that the traditional surgeons in the Bill itself, that they should follow up on the initiates. I'm not sure if that is a cultural practice across the board or if it's just only amongst the Kwa and Tabele, but I think we have to be very sensitive to the different ethnic groups and the manner in which they conduct the various initiation practices, because that is one issue we do have. There are various practices, and you have to know all of the cultural practices in order to be able to pick up if you have a cultural deviation or not. But in any event, we did, by means of, set up a team of SAPS members, who mainly consisted of people from the Kwa and the Bele that had undergone the initiation practice out of respect, of course, for the culture, you know, and for the chief who owns the initiation school. We didn't want to impose on the cultural practices. So they went, they investigated, they came back. And we did take some action. And I'm pleased to announce that since then, very few cases of initiation-related deaths, male circumcision deaths, have been reported now. So it seems that the whole issue of creating awareness in Mpumalanga has really assisted. The nice thing about Limpopo and what we've noticed is about Limpopo is we've, at the time when we were in charge of Limpopo, I come from Gauteng, Pretoria. Limpopo, we never really had a problem at all. Now, your age issue is an issue in contravention of the Act, but we won't go there. But we didn't really hear these issues from Limpopo for the simple reason that, in my view, Limpopo's control mechanisms, monitoring mechanisms, proactiveness is what protects those initiates. If we do not have proper administration, proper understanding, proper follow-ups, proactiveness, we are going to see deaths. And that is something we want to avoid. If a matter has to come to the NPA, it's a sad day, because it only comes to the NPA if there has been a death, if there has been assault or some kind of crime. So one wants to prevent interference by the NPA, because that would mean that some form of harm was caused. So we don't want that. We want to ensure that the cultural practices people are proud of, they continue with these, but within certain parameters that allow the initiates to come through this process unscathed and achieve the purpose that they went in there to do so, that they return to their families, and we don't have issues of death. So part of that was also at that stage in 2013, very little was known about the Children's Act 38 of 2005. Nobody understood that when you circumcise children, you are bound by the provisions of Section 12 of this Act, and they didn't understand how it is to be applied. So I've been asked just quickly to go through those provisions of this Act with second one, thank you. just to quickly go through the provisions of this particular Act. Now, there was a question relating to why the 16 to 18, that is because of the provisions of this specific Act. Now, the Children's Act draws a distinction between two categories of children. The child that falls below the age of 16 and the child between the categories of 16 to 18. When it comes to male circumcision, according to the provisions of this Act, male circumcision of children below the age of 16, unless it is for religious reasons or medical reasons, may not be conducted. All right, so it's totally illegal. When it comes to the age group 16 to 18 and male circumcision, it can be done, but here's the thing. It is the child who must give written approval. There's a specified form, there's a specified procedure that needs to be followed. So you will notice also in terms of the bill, there are a few sections, and I will go through them when I'm dealing with the bill, that deals with consent by both parents and the child. In terms of this specific Act, all that is required for compliance with the Children's Act for children between the ages of 16 and 18 is that they give written consent, not that the parents also give written consent. Okay? So in other words, what the Act is saying is, to my mind, what it's saying is, We must allow children to be able to consciously apply their choices to their lives, because it is their bodily integrity, it is their privacy, it is their dignity. Therefore, in terms of a constitutional provision, we should allow these children to exercise their rights, if they want to choose to follow this cultural practice or not. Hence, they give that specific consent in writing. So, in terms of male circumcision for religious purposes, there is no distinction in the age groups. It is allowed. It is usually done as soon as the child is born, or a few days after recently. It is very common amongst the Jewish and the Muslim communities. So that the child is circumcised within a sterile environment, close to birth, etc., and that is their religious practice. So it does not apply in that specific instance. May we move to the next slide? So when we consider this bill, we have considered it in light of all of those documents there, the Constitution, the Children's Act, and the one thing I need to emphasize is that the nice thing about this bill is that the bill will create a national legislation that will be applicable to all provinces. As you all know, every province, every municipality, as we stand now, have different rules pertaining to initiation. One municipality will have a certain bylaw, the other municipality next door will have something else. So this unifies the whole situation and gives you a nationally applicable body of rules that say all of you comply with this specifically. So that's one nice thing about it. What I do foresee when this particular bill is enacted, I think by way of teething problems, we are going to see a clash between provincial laws and this national law. But in terms of the Constitution, this specific law of general application should actually triumph. Okay? Now, can we move on, please? All right. So the other thing that we have noticed in terms of the Mpumalanga initiation, the male initiation schools, were that there were many role players here. We had, if I remember correctly, in 2013, the Department of Health was actually quite proactive, and they got together with the House of Traditional Leaders and some of the chiefs and formed an Ngoma Forum, and there was some training provided to certain traditional surgeons who lent themselves to the process of being trained on how to perform the circumcisions, the various hygiene things, and they were given a certain kit. But the chiefs were never obliged to use those specific persons.
Yes.
So, unfortunately, you had other types of people that were also brought into the mix, and they would go ahead and circumcise these children who eventually supposed to turn out to be men under circumstances that were not so very conducive. Okay. So it's a good thing to have this bill, because then their entire environment is then being controlled in a better way. All right. The other issue that we had is, apart from the circumciser who was either appointed by the family of the initiate or by the chief, whichever, you would have, of course, your normal principals, your caregivers, and the chief, and so on. The issues were, in that particular environment, is the various roles that each of these people played within this setup. And that is also a nice thing about the bill, is that it sets out the various duties of the various role players, which is fantastic, because that never really occurred in that kind of an environment previously. Next slide, please.
Okay, next one. Okay, carry on. Okay, so when we dealt with infringements, particularly when dealing with the deaths that arose out of the 2013 matters, we tended to charge with murder if we had enough of the case, or culpable homicide, or a contravention of the Section 12 of the Children's Act. But it becomes difficult in that perspective to try and prove your case, because one of the secrecy involved in the entire process, and two, there had to be a balancing act that one doesn't want to infringe upon cultural practice, but we also need to prosecute. And here is the issue I have with this specific bill about the secrecy of certain practices within initiation schools. Now, I understand that there must be some secrecy, and I understand that it is not usually, particularly when it comes to male circumcision, it is not a female's ground to go around in. And that was one difficulty that I was experiencing, because the matters just landed on my table. And as a female, I had to try and respect that as well. So I was supervising from a distance by letting the men go out and do this and that and so on. It's difficult. Now, when you're prosecuting a case, and if you have to deal with secrecy within a particular grouping, then nobody wants to cooperate. So on the one hand, there is a demand by public that there must be a prosecution. There must be accountability for the death. And then we have the issue of we have to respect the cultural practices. So one is in a catch-22 situation. And in as much as the NPA tries to respect cultural practices, we also have a job to do. And the Act, as it stands, the Children's Act, is something we have to enforce. If there is a contravention, it is brought to our attention, we have to enforce it. That is the role of the National Prosecuting Authority. We have to do that. But we try to do that with great sensitivity to cultural practices, because we're also bound to respect cultural practices. So the Balancing Act is difficult. So where you have secrecy, if that secrecy extends to something that pertains to allowing the prosecutorial services doing their job, or the SOPA from doing their job, it becomes a problem. Because usually what happens in all of this is that X will say, no, sorry, this initiate, I wasn't his principal, or this initiate was circumcised by somebody I didn't see. Or the chief will say, but I got this person to circumcise. Nobody told me that this initiate was sick. So there is always that kind of issue. And one has to bear in mind also, and I say this with the deepest of respect, is that not all chiefs are literate. And they place their trust by virtue of a person's familial background, that they are now a trusted traditional surgeon or whatever it is. That chief places his trust in that person to conduct a circumcision in a manner that will benefit the initiate and the family of that initiate. And when the circumcision is botched, for whatever reason, whether it is lack of experience, because it's amazing, sometimes you do see very young people that are conducting circumcisions, and they've not done it before. They've not had previous training, so it becomes a problem. So it's not the chief that is a problem. The chief tries, and the trust is placed on the circumciser to perform his or her his duties in a proper manner. So that was the other issue that we had. We did try as far as possible. As I said, I keep wanting to change the slide here. We also encounter a situation, and this is a problem now as well,
particularly with the new demarcation of jurisdictional areas in Mpumalanga and Limpopo, where the children from Limpopo are being brought across to Mpumalanga. And illegal schools are being held here in Mpumalanga because they're fleeing Limpopo's. So it is something to be aware of, that that kind of movement does happen. And I even remember a case where a child opened an initiation school. He himself was, I think, 16, and he was supposed to be the head of this initiation school. So things like this do happen, the cross-border, so to speak, migration, where people try to avoid that specific house of traditional leaders, because Limpopo has been known to actually enforce things rather strictly. I do remember the one morning I woke up, there was news about an illegal school. 2 hours later, the school was closed. So that kind of fantastic proaction that we see coming from Limpopo. With regards to children being, and the word was used earlier, abduction, all right? The word abduction is used in it very commonly. And what actually people mean in their minds is kidnapping or child stealing. That's what they mean. But they sort of, in common language, they would use it as synonyms for each other, whereas the legal definitions of those two terms are very different. So the stats is correct that when it comes to abduction, there is that common law definition. But as soon as it comes to the NPA, those charges are then rectified and so on. So the thought process of children being abducted is something that is common, but I think it is commonly used in the context that it is a malapropism for the word kidnapping. So that's why we are seeing that confusion. It's basically that we are talking about kidnapping. But what happens in cases of kidnapping is that a parent will go to the police and say, look, my child was seen getting into a vehicle, and the other members have informed me, my neighbors have told me that they were going to an initiation school. Parent goes to the SAPS goes to that specific initiation school after they have traced everything, and then the child says, but they didn't take me, I wanted to go voluntarily. And that is the problem, that we have children who go voluntarily for, and it seems to me at this stage that there's a bit of peer pressure. So they sort of go because even people that don't belong to a specific ethnic group that requires that you be circumcised, it's something's going on with the kids these days, that they actually really feel that they must go to an initiation school. I think it is a lot of peer pressure. But that is the problem in cases of kidnapping. The child says, no, I went here with consent. So the child is removed, and believe it or not, the child goes back. Then he's circumcised, and then there are issues that come from that. And then now who do you blame? Point fingers at. So it is a very difficult situation. Next slide, please, sir. Next one. Okay. So in terms of the act in itself, I gave you very basically the differences in the age categories when it comes to male circumcision, those below 16 and 16 to 18. And that is basically really because these slides were meant for prosecutors that I trained. But that's basically what one needs to keep in mind, that there is this difference in laws pertaining to those specific age groups for a reason. Generally, children below the age of 16 are seen to be too immature to be able to make up their mind for themselves. So we say no. Not until that child is able to exercise proper consent for themselves. Okay. Do we have any issues pertaining to the act in itself now? Can I move on to the bill very quickly?
Chairperson, can I just ask a question quickly to advocate? Thanks. So in terms of the MMC program, are we violating the Children's Act if we circumcising 10 to 15 years?
Yes, you are. If you are circumcising those children for any other reason other than medical or religious reasons, you are violating the Act. The HPCSA, insofar as my memory serves me, actually had a training program when the Children's Act came out for medical practitioners, and I'm not sure if they still have that medical program. But yes, you are contravening the Act. And even when it is done in terms of for religious purposes, you still have certain forms you've got to fill out. So this specific Act is being contravened regularly.
Follow up, sir, Chairperson. So, what we're saying is that medical males is a medical intervention to prevent HIV infections, like a vaccine. So, we are then saying we are governed by the surgical laws and not by the Children's Act, because now it's a matter of consent, but consenting for the child, and the child assenting that they would want to be circumcised. So there's no coercion, but it follows now the medical laws and not the Children's Act. Because a 12-year-old can consent for an abortion, or a 12-year-old can consent for an HIV test, but the same 12-year-old cannot consent for a medical circumcision.
Okay, remember that the qualification was for religious purposes or medical purposes. So a circumcision that is conducted for medical purposes is not illegal. But for any other circumstance in that age group, it is illegal. So, yes. So that is the qualification that is there. And remember that we didn't make the law. We only implement the law. So that is the law, and it's there for a specific reason. So it seems to me that in your circumstance, you're actually doing it for medical reasons. And if it's for medical reasons, then it complies. I did speak about the definition of the term sacred and secret in Section 1 of the bill and the problem that it's going to pose for prosecution. So it is hoped that people will use will not interpret that to actually be a condemnation for them to prevent investigation from being conducted in a proper manner or from prosecution to be conducted in a specific matter. Then we go to Section 15(2) of the bill, and that requires, that goes, is in regards to the documents, and it does not, in Section 15(2) does not specify that the, no, it's not on that, it's another presentation. It's fine, you can put that off, thank you. Section 15(2) does not anywhere specify that there should be a control of those documents that is required by the Children's Act. Those are the consent forms that is required, and I think it's important that these documents be kept on file so that if there is an investigation, SAPS requires that it is readily at hand. Insofar as Section 22 goes, I think it goes to wordiness, really, Section 22, 1A and B. The use of the word child in Sections 22, 1A and B
Now, the use of the word child will, by its very definition, include a child below the age of 60. And in this context, we do know that in terms of the Act, children below the age of 16 may not be circumcised. So there is that qualification again, that in this context, it does not refer to a child below the age of 16. It cannot refer to a child below the age of 16. In terms of the traditional surgeon, that will be Section 23, and that was the issue that I had spoken about earlier about traditional surgeons following the progress or the medical progress of the initiates. I think we do need clarity from the different groupings whether that is actually allowed in the various under the various types of male initiation practices that we do have. Section 24, which is something that I just realized while I was sitting here, is that Section 24 with regards to medical practitioners, what I think we has was forgotten here is that medical practitioners that conduct circumcision for religious purposes, I think have been excluded from this specific section, and perhaps one needs to look at that section again. The issues of consent, as I indicated in Section 28, Subsection 3A, as I said, the issue of consent when you're dealing with a child between the ages of 16 and 18 is that the child's consent is written, is required and has to be in writing. The specific in the bill, it says that the parents must also give consent. What can potentially happen is that you have a situation where the parents don't consent, then the child consents, and then you have a conflict between the laws, because the specific law will be of the same status as the Children's Act, so we don't want a conflict of laws arising from that. But other than that, the rest of the bill is fine. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Advocate, for assisting us. It's a very helpful documentation is here. It will assist us also. Hopefully, the department also will take some of the issues that are raised. Honorable Malam Malulega.
Thanks, Chair. Just a couple of quick comments. First of all, under the current legislation and regime, how many cases are you prosecuting with relation to traditional initiation at the moment, and how many have been successful? I'm just trying to get an idea of is the current legislation lacking in some way? The second thing is you spoke about the paper trail in Section 15 of the bill and the necessity to keep the documents, and that you felt that Section 15 was inadequate. Can I just ask you, Section 15 specifically at the very start talks about the PICC keeping a database of each initiation school, which must include, and then it lists all the things that it must include, the reports, the daily visitor records, the financial reports, the information on initiates, the medical consent forms. All of those things need to form part of that database. Is that insufficient? Is there some way that we could beef that up? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Advocate, I just want to understand maybe what is your take on the religion factor and the culture? What is the difference there? Because I think in my culture, if I believe that circumcision should be at the age of 3 months, it's how I believe, it's my religion. How do you differentiate between culture and religion? And on this thing of age, don't we see it as discriminatory if we are allowing others on the basis of religion and medical reasons, and others we are saying we are going to prosecute them if they circumcise or they take their children for initiation below the age of 16? Are we going to win in court, if I'm a lawyer and I represent a parent who takes his or her child to initiation at the age of 10 or 13, and I raise these issues that if you are discriminating him or her on the basis of religion or medical reasons. Thank you, John.
Advocate, my problem is one, that we are all in this thing because of a lot of deaths that has been happening all along. And I wonder why NPA has been failing us for so many years not to prosecute these people that are circumcising the children below the age of 16, if the law stipulates that. And how many cases do you have currently that have finally been processed through this act, if that's the case? And lastly, I still find it difficult to understand what Mem Maluleka has raised, the issue of the religious vis-a-vis traditional. And in the bill, well, I've got right now your slides. I wanted you to see where you comment in terms of this age group and also of the traditional doctors vis-a-vis the medical doctors. I would want to hear your comment on that as to how the NPA is dealing with such issues. Thanks.
And in Mpumalanga, there has been quite a few prosecutions, several of them. We have had acquittals on those, but we've had at least three cases, I think, where we've had guilty findings. And that was basically in contravention of the specific act. A number of them are now at the stage of inquest. We've got about seven more coming arising from the 2013 matters. Both in Witbank and Middelburg. So we did see from the 2013 incident a lot of those matters come out. Some of them were subject to representations, and in as much as we are asked here today, what are we doing to do so? You know, as I indicated earlier, the duty of the national prosecuting authorities to enforce the laws, to prosecute for a contravention of a specific law. But we're also trying to respect cultural practices. So we are in a catch-22 situation when we deal with this sort of thing. We try to respect the culture, but we also have a duty to conduct. So cases have been placed in the role, representations have been received on behalf of, say, the medical practitioner, who was a circumciser, or the traditional surgeon who was the circumciser in that specific regard. Some of the representations were successful, some of them not. And in a lot of the cases, we have had inquests. So we have had a few of those cases, and we've had a few successes in those cases as well. Your second question was Section 15. If you could quickly bring to my attention the consent forms, please. Under where is it? Okay, I found it. Okay. Sorry, that was an omission on my part. So that will be withdrawn.
So that's okay.
Yes. Sorry, I didn't see that particular point. The next one, I have to inform the Honourable Member,
I'm a lawyer. I'm not a philosopher. If you give me a good old-fashioned criminal matter, I will give you my expertise in that. Philosophy, not my thing. Basically, my understanding of religion versus culture is that religion is usually a belief system that is dependent on a written word, like the text, Bible, or Quran, or the Torah, or whatever. Cultural practices is the belief system of a specific grouping of people. Now, I didn't come out with this legislation, and I didn't draw the distinction between religion and culture, but I do know that when the law was being considered, many groupings were actually invited to comment in this particular regard, and I'm not sure why these kinds of comments were not made at that stage, but we can only enforce what is written, and we try to do that. I mean, you yourself have heard the gentleman asking, why is the NPA not doing anything? Others are saying, but why are you prosecuting? It's my religion, it's not my culture. So that is the law. We enforce the law, and that is what's being done. The third aspect was, I think I've covered all your questions. Oh, the distinction between traditional surgeons and medical doctors. If one has to have regard to the provisions in the Children's Act, that's Section 12, and the regulations pertaining to that, and if you read it very carefully, there is no distinction being made between a medical doctor, particularly with regards to male circumcision 16 to 18, and a traditional surgeon. So the standards to which a traditional surgeon should aspire to should actually be those that are medically approved standards, you know, the standards of hygiene and so on and so forth. So that is where this bill is going to be very, very helpful in making sure that that practice is followed by both categories of people.
It's really not on religion or culture, but it's politics. That we have a situation where thousands upon thousands of initiates go into the process between the age of 9 to 14, 15. An example of that is in the book, or even younger, certain areas of the book, stronger speaking and so on. Now, we have a situation here where the law is in conflict with society. That's the contradiction that needs to be addressed. I would say that it will be very useful for the NPA to verify first what we're saying here, and to assist us resolve the problem, because this bill must be tabled and be accepted by Parliament, and this kind of conflict can lead to various problems and difficulties. So that's why I'm just raising it, so that the issue is noted, and it's not just a small little issue. It's a problem of the law being in conflict with the society, fundamentally. Because it's a cultural practice that people have engaged in for years and years and centuries. So we need to find a solution.
No, the advocate is right. Lawmakers are members of parliament. Advocate is raising some contradiction in terms of our laws. It is our duty, I guess, to explain this thing easy for them to enforce the law. A
and then I agree that we are right, advocate. You are not a philosopher. You want to deal with those who break the law, even if you can think the law is, but this law is a little bit backward. Your duty is to implement, enforce the law. I don't think we'll have a choice, but this law is bad. Why should I enforce this law? I think we'll have a moral dilemma. I think we have to implement the law. If the law says no, except religious reasons or medical issues, I think the department is covered on medical issues because they're doing this for medical reasons, assisting us to fight against HIV and AIDS. Therefore, they're not breaking the law that is existing now. And those, of course, who are cultural issues is a separate issue completely. I just think that members, we must avoid a situation where people say that, because we can also go for extreme of explaining culture ended up with what we call honor killing. Is the honor killing. If you make so embarrassing thing in the family, I can kill you. You can't allow a situation like that because life prevails under all circumstances. You can't have a law and force us say, no, it's a cultural view, even if there's life is in danger. Because I thought that life is something that is protected by the Constitution and the state. There's no compromise in terms of life. Compromise can be about other things, but can't compromise about life. If children are dying there, you can't have an MPA, maybe they are female, all of them, that they can't enter, but they know that people are dying there. Because in them, that no, there's cultural issue. I don't think it works that way anyway. Because otherwise, we can also blackmail our law enforcers. Say, no, you can't come here, we're a woman. You can't come here because we're not circumcised in the bush, but we're circumcised in the hospital. Then I think we can cause harm with society. Life takes precedence in all circumstances. Generally, we can't compromise on life. It's a duty of the state to protect life of every human being. You can't have organs of state who want to negotiate culture. That is culture, is your religion. And then if you are a sect, a richer sect, honorable Mason, they want to burn all of you because the day has ended. And then security stand up, but it's their religion. If they bend themselves, they must bend themselves. I don't think it can work that way. In general, we must be careful about this thing of culture and religion in terms of life of people. We'll talk about it after we have saved life. Then we can then talk about that and see what we want to do. I think advocates have assisted us a lot. And then I think their presentation is helpful, is written. As we consider some of the issues, if there are many issues that as you go back, you say, hey, man, this is an issue that is critical. Please, just link up with us. The secretary is here. And then the department is there. Dr. Pesters and the team, they're there. And then you can also touch base with them. Then we can address some of these challenges. And then I think we should do that, colleagues. I don't think we can exhaust the presentation now. It was just to raise issues ourselves, must apply our mind. As we deal with this bill clause by clause. Surely if there's issue that we can call them to come back, they will always be available, advocate. Come back and assist here and there. And then surely the cultural activists and Honorable Mteto, they can also be called to come and assist you. Honorable Masip is a cultural activist. And then in general, I think that's what we should do, colleagues. And call also other colleagues to come in and make their presentation. Advocate, we have assisted us a lot on these issues. And then we have to deal with them. I know the department is here, they've taken points. As we deal clause by clause, you can call you and also come in and explain some of the issues in terms of enforceability of the law. That's what we can do, really. Thank you very much for coming. Very helpful for us. Very, very helpful. Thanks very much. Thanks for your subs and the team. Women? Who is representing women here? Department? Okay. Come this side. Come this side. Don't be far away from us. We know that women are not allowed to enter the field like this.
Good morning, Chairperson and Portfolio Committee members. My name is Shoki Shabalala. I'm the Acting Director General in the Department of Women. I am accompanied by the Director responsible for the unit that pertains to issues of governance and social transformation and justice issues in the department. I will do the opening remarks and I will then hand over to Director Sipili Lenduli to then talk us through the presentation. Once more, thank you for affording us the opportunity to present commentary on the impact of the bill on the status of women in particular. And I would like to indicate that the Department of Women is responding to this bill within the following context that she will then be talking to us on them, that there's a gender dimension to initiation, no matter whether it is customary, traditional, or modern. Some of the emerging questions are that we will be talking to: does the process result in victims? Does this process result in harmful practices? Who actually are the victims as we look into this whole process? Who is negatively affected by the practice itself? And in what way are they affected from a perspective of women? We will then, I'll then hand over to the director to take us through the issues. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, DG. Through you, Chairperson, our main concern, of course, is the tension between what is in the Constitution and this debate we've been having regarding religion and culture. But before we get into that, Chairperson, I would respectfully like to state that our work in the department is governed by a paradigm that we call a gender mainstreaming paradigm. And what that paradigm requires us to do is to communicate effectively with the state, understanding that we are incredibly undercapacitated. So in order for our work to be effective, we require the buy-in of the state at large, including particularly Parliament. In that regard, the work of, say, for example, the presentations we've heard today from the police, from the NPA, and from health. What is required by gender mainstreaming is that in discussing the perspective of the Department of Health regarding the customary initiation bill, we would want to hear how women are affected in particular. When we listen to the presentation from the NPA, for example, we would want to hear how they believe that women are affected. Because when that is not done, Chairperson, then it leaves us, the smallest departments of the state, undercapacitated, to then go back, take their presentations, and conduct a gender analysis. Indirectly, if that is not done, what that does is perpetuate further gender inequalities in even these customary and religious practices. So that is the first point that I'd like to make, Chairperson. And with that, it is just to respectfully plead that perhaps as we move forward with this process, we request other state departments, civil society organizations. I saw that COSATU made a presentation today. As we request their comments, we would request as the Department of Women respectfully that the Portfolio Committee assist us in asking them explicitly to ensure that in all their presentations, they ensure that there's a gender analysis in that. So moving forward, Chairperson, as the Acting DG has explained, our main focus is on the gender dynamic of initiation. And of course, initiation as a rite of passage that affects both women and that affects men. And of course, then the cultural context in which initiation occurs. And our role is then, or our focus is to look at the disempowerment of women through the denial of voice and through the denial of power. And this happens because of the overarching context of patriarchy that we live in the world. With that, we believe that it's incredibly important to be able to distinguish between customary initiation for boys and customer initiation for girls. I've already mentioned the tensions between the Constitution and traditional practices, which I will elaborate on later in this presentation, and then, of course, the patriarchal considerations in the practice of customer initiation, and thereafter, the role of communities, of families, of cultures, and traditional beliefs in the practice of customer initiation. So then, in differentiating between initiation for boys and for girls, when we look at customer initiation for boys in particular, the context and the current challenges from a gender perspective are the abductions into initiation schools, taking into consideration the discussion we've already had about the differences between what abduction is and what kidnapping is. And then, of course, the cross-border abductions that we've already spoken about as well, and child trafficking therein, the emergence of illegal and dangerous initiation schools, deaths of initiates and the economic impact therein, the targeting and coercion of single-parent boys or boys who come from single-parent homes, the issues around botched circumcisions, the psychological issues such as that lead to issues such as suicide and violent tendencies and economic impact. I'd just like to pause there, Chairperson, and to speak to this point. We've been consulting with a number of NGOs, and one of the NGOs we consulted with that look specifically at these issues, through them we heard of some of the most atrocious consequences of botched circumcisions. In some instances, boys who have then been psychologically affected by what has happened to them because of this will then take it out on girls. They will rape girls with objects, terrible experiences because of these practices. Therefore, when we look at issues, for example, like botched circumcisions of boys, we also then have to look at what happens as a result of that. And our clue is the overarching context of patriarchy. Everything happens within that context. So whatever that boys are affected by, they are relating with women, whether women be their mothers, sisters, girlfriends. And those effects, whatever happens in the mountain, that is going to affect how they relate with women. And then, of course, there's the disconnection between the spiritual links and the economic factors. I'm going to speak in more detail about that as well, and the denial of and or granting of voice and agency, the recruitment of boys into gangsterism, and the migrant labor system. So just to go back to all of these points, when we speak about the migrant labor system, which is a legacy of our apartheid and colonial eras, where men usually leave particularly rural homesteads and even townships, and they go into mining communities to make money for families. Girls and boys are raised by women in households. Then it is the effects of those social dynamics on issues such as cultural and religious practices that we look at from a gender perspective. When boys or girls want to go to initiation, the first point of call is going to be the mother. The mother gives consent, but in that, the mother herself is a woman in a patriarchal society. So the notion of consent, or whether the mother can say yes or no to this boy or girl going to initiation, is not just about her own agency. It's a matter of agency and power. This woman is operating in a particular context. If she says no, she still has to get out of the house. What happens if she says no, or if she says yes? And what happens to this child if the mother says yes or no? So it's those dynamics that we as the Department of Women are also concerned about. There's also then the recruitment of boys into gangsterism, which is related to the economic consequences of male circumcision. The speaker from the Department of Health, I believe, earlier spoke a little bit into this, which is the commercialization of initiation schools. And this, we applaud this bill, or the idea behind this bill, because it seeks to regulate. And in the process of regulation, we might then also be able to prevent things like the recruitment of boys into gangsterism through these illegal initiation schools. And then, of course, with that are the links between spirituality and the economic factors. When in a world that is driven mainly by materiality, gradually you move away from the initial or the founding principles around what initiation schools were conceptualized. And initially, initiation schools were around issues of, as the representative from NPA has discussed, religion, culture, and these spiritual connotations that had little to nothing to do with money. But as the world becomes more globalized, as our belief systems become more commercialized, then these initiation schools and these customary practices also become commercialized. The question then for us is, what are the consequences of all of these developments on the status of women, particularly women in rural areas who have less money? So when your girl or your boy is abducted and gangsters call you or come to your house and say, we want 7,000 rand if you want your child to be safe, and you're a woman and you either a single parent with the father of this child is either gone or just dead or not around because of the legacy of colonialism and apartheid, what then do you do about your child who's been abducted? These are the issues that are concerning us. If I have left anything out, Chairperson, Acting DG is going to assist us. Then when we look at customer initiation practices that pertain to girls, we acknowledge that these occur at a lower rate than boys, and this is why perhaps when we speak, discourse around initiation normally concentrates on boys because of this. However, initiation practices as they pertain to girls also deserve equal attention, or else all we do then is reproduce historical gender inequalities. And the main practices we look at are female genital mutilation and virginity testing. With regards to female genital mutilation, we understand that this occurs mainly in Gauteng, Limpopo, and Eastern Cape. And this also then brings us back to the questions around religion and culture. When you have a law that seeks to protect life and seeks to, and you have founding principles that speak to the rights of all people, to dignity in society, and then you have a religion, because religion and culture are issues of identity. So if one is raised in a context where it is believed that a woman has to have their vagina sewed for the sexual pleasure of a man, those are questions that we have to ask ourselves. What is the relationship between this belief and what the Constitution says? What is this, what is the relationship between this religious or cultural belief and the dignity of this woman? Same goes with virginity testing and reed dancing. We understand that these are incredibly sensitive issues because these are contexts we've grown up around. These are norms, but these are questions that must also be asked. And these are debates that are there in our society that deserve our attention as the Department of Women. Virginity testing and reed dancing as it pertains to women, who does it serve firstly? Does it serve to protect the dignity of women, or does it serve to advance sexist beliefs and patriarchal notions of what it means to be alive? And then, of course, related to that is issues of girls as well, like boys. There are girls who are abducted to initiation schools, and in some cases they are abducted by women. What this shows is that patriarchy and sexism is not reserved for men. It is a societal concern that affects men and women, and it is advanced, sustained, and reproduced by men and women equally. And then, of course, there are issues of denial and granting of voice and agency that we need to look at, and when we speak, of course, of abductions and trafficking, we are looking at cross-border issues. What happens with girls in that regard? As we think about these issues and the differences between customary practices as they pertain to boys and girls, then there are some points to consider. For us as a department, one of these main points, and they've been highlighted since we started this meeting today, are the tensions between Western forms of initiation and African customary practices. And at the center of this, of course, is the use of evidence as political weapon or as a political entity. And a good example for us to, I guess, a good reference to make is during the presentation, I think the NPA, we spoke about the difference between religion and culture would be perhaps evidenced by what is written. And there's a whole history around the codification of what is customary and what is religious, and the use of that codification to legitimize what is Western against what is African. So you do not codify what is African so that you present it as non-legitimate, and you codify what is Western so that you legitimize it. And those are questions that we need to ask as we consider what is religious, what is customary, and what is culture. And then, of course, there are issues of the commercialization of initiation practices. And I've spoken to this earlier, which is that customarily traditional surgeons and nurses had to possess both skills and a spiritual calling. You couldn't be a traditional surgeon if it wasn't a spiritual calling. However, because of the times that we are living in and the increased commercialization of these practices, we are moving more and more away from that. And then, of course, with that, the underlying issues are notions of neocolonialism as they pertain to spiritual and physical well-being of African people. And with this is the role of NGOs in the professionalization of spirituality. And this speaks back to the use of evidence as a political entity and a political weapon. When you have people, particularly in rural areas, who might not be well-skilled in research methods, who might not have the necessary tools that are needed to compete in a more global research space, but they understand what they are talking about. How do you resolve those conflicts? I think those are issues that the portfolio committee should also consider. And then, of course, with that comes the stigmatization of those who undergo medical male circumcision as opposed to, and the representative from the Department of Health earlier spoke to that. These are important questions to consider because we are finding that some boys in particular will be taken by their parents to a medical doctor, a Western medical doctor, but because of social pressures, what it means to be a man, the idea of hegemonic masculinity, when they go out into the world and it is found out that they went to a medical, a Western medical doctor as opposed to a traditional medical doctor, then they are seen to be less men than those who went to mountains. And some of these boys have to then go back to the mountain to do this procedure again. So it becomes less about medical practices and more about culture, what we as society understand to be what it means to be either men or women. And these are issues that have to be considered also as we make these laws, because laws, in return, then create societies. And then, of course, looking at the impact of initiation on women and girls, the main question that we ask is who provides consent? I spoke to this earlier. In most instances, because of issues of migration and legacies of apartheid, most households are led or headed by women, so they have to give consent. But when we speak about the notion of consent, we also then have to consider that it's not just a matter of saying yes or no. A yes or a no is informed by broader issues of society, and these also have to be considered. We spoke about the fact that a lot of abductees come from single-parent homes. Where a man is present in a house, you are less likely to find that the child is abducted. So those are also issues that need to be considered. There are also child-headed households, households that are headed by young girls. And a 12-year-old girl who has a brother who's been told by his friends next door that he's going to the mountain, and he comes to the sister who's a preteen herself and says, I also want to go. There are those issues to consider, especially as we also consider notions of age. I've spoken about ransom, I've spoken about botched circumcisions, and the results of what happens when boys, sometimes boys come out of circumcision with botched penises, I guess. And then women who bear the brunt of challenges, including financial demands and the deaths of their children. So whether the child is injured or whether the child is dead, there are still financial repercussions that women have to bear. It's the woman who has to bury her child, and it's also the woman who has to go to a loan shark to borrow 7,000-10,000 rand to assist her son or her daughter. There are also then issues of, which is a really, really concerning issue, this tension between law and society that the representative, Advocate Mohammed, spoke to earlier. In many traditional areas where the traditional leader is a woman, there are more challenges than areas where the traditional leader is a man, because women are not privy to what happens during male circumcision. So as a traditional leader, you are to provide leadership about what happens in this community. But because you are not privy to what happens in the mountain, then you have limited understanding. And with that limited understanding, your decision-making powers are also limited. So these are also then issues that affect women that have to be considered around the secrecy of culture and religion and what then it says about the ability of women traditional leaders to perform their functions, the ability of the police to perform their functions, or at a more material level, the ability of Advocate Mohammed to do her job of ensuring that whoever is responsible for someone's death is prosecuted. She can't do that because she's not privy to what happens in the mountain. So those issues must also then be looked at. And I mean, broadly speaking, the contextual approach to this presentation is women in relation to family, in relation to culture, in relation to the economy, and in relation to society. And, of course, consent as a preventative measure against harmful practices. That is our main point, this issue of consent. And, of course, we would want to see the role of traditional leaders strengthened in order to prevent harm. And then, of course, there's this issue that I haven't yet spoken to, which is initiation and LGBTI issues. And this, of course, we've had Inxeba, the film, which assisted us all to then start speaking publicly around the discourse with the LGBTI community and what happens in the mountain. And I think the bill also needs to be more explicit around protecting the rights of the LGBTI community to their own religious or customary practices. So with that, our recommendations, Chairperson, are that the bill has to consider the age of consent, which has already been discussed in depth during this meeting, whereas the Schools Act says one thing, the Department of Health will say one thing, and traditional leaders in Limpopo will say one thing. How then do we protect the lives of South Africans according to the Constitution if we are saying different things? Then we would also then respectfully want to ask the Portfolio Committee to consider punitive measures against abductions of boys and girls into initiation schools. And lastly, which I've spoken at great length about, and which is the main point of our presentation, would be that that preventative measures have to center on the notion of consent, of voice, and of agency, but not just looking at the matter of a yes or no. Looking at who says yes, who says no, why they say yes, and why they say no, and what the broader economic, social, and even political factors that play a huge contributing factor to why people say yes or no. Chairperson, thank you. If ADG will assist with us.
Chairperson, I'm comfortable with what has been said to committee members. The only area of concern, and now that I've been listening to Advocate's presentation, is whether we need to have the various legislation harmonized from an age perspective, or whether we just take guidance or cue from the Constitution point of view. And I'm telling you this because I just want to make one example, even though it doesn't relate to this specifically. The issue of early marriages of girl children. In some instances, you get told that a girl child with the consent of the parent can marry, even though they are below 18 years. On the other hand, the Children's Act says a child is a child as long as, you know, the definition of a child for 18 years. And we've also been recommending harmonization of the two laws so that the Marriage Act, which is led by the Department of Home Affairs, and the Children's Act, led by the Department of Social Development, in partnership with the Department of Women, should really come together and talk about these issues so that we make a decision. Does it require harmonization, or we just take you from, you know, what the Constitution says on these matters and we take it from there? Those are some of the issues that we will have to put to the public domain for further discussion as well and debate.
Thank you very much, colleagues, for raising the issues. I thought, DG, there would be no question about which one is the supreme law. I thought the Constitution is supreme. There's no negotiation about what the Constitution says is supreme. All other laws that are subservient to the law of the lawyers. Because otherwise, we would have a problem. That's why point that I was raising, Mashabala. You see, when we have state organs themselves not sure what the Constitution says, then would be a problem. Because all laws, they never contradict the Constitution. You can't have a law that this one is the, what is the Malema one, the Melhem one. Then Melhem is Melhem, then they go their own ways. I think we can cause havoc with society. The Constitution is there, Bill of Rights is there, everything comes from there. Anything that is contrary to that can't be respected by society, general. And Melham wanted to make a point? Okay.
Chair, I have a couple of concerns here. First of all, I welcome the presentation from the Department of Women. I think it has some interesting insights. I am a little concerned that it doesn't talk directly to the bill. In other words, a lot of the issues that you speak about, let me give you an example, the issue of consent. There's a whole section here on consent. Now, how would you propose that we strengthen that, or how would you propose that we address some of the concerns? You know, we can't have exactly what the chairperson has just said. We can't have one set of rules for one group of people and another set of rules for another group of people. We're trying here to make legislation that is uniformly applicable, that is, a law of general application is the constitutional term. So how can we fix what's here to address that example of consent? How can we make it stronger in the case of child-headed households? You know, in the bill itself, in the section on consent, it talks to the fact that a person between the ages of 16 and 18 may not attend an initiation school for the purposes of being initiation unless such person and his or her parents or customary or legal guardian, as the case may be, give written consent. Now, how do we make that stronger? What do we need to do? If it's a 14-year-old girl who is the head of the household, is she the legal guardian? Is she the customary guardian? If she's not, who is, and how do we get that into this legislation? The second part is, I'm just looking at that screen in front of me there where you say the Portfolio Committee to consider punitive measures against abductions of boys and girls into initiation schools. I'm not sure if we're reading the same bill, because this bill does exactly that. It says that it is an offence for a person to be taken against their will to an initiation school. It says that they can't be held against their will. It says that there needs to be the consent of the parent as well as the child to go to an initiation school. So again, I have a disconnect with what I'm hearing from you, and I'm not disputing any of the facts that you're putting on the table. I'm saying that how do we address it in this legislation? I would have thought that there would have been a greater emphasis, particularly on the areas of initiation of females, in particularly the section on female genital mutilation, in particularly the section on virginity testing. Do you support that? Is it okay? Can we proceed with it as it is? Does it need to be strengthened? What I'm not getting out of the presentation here is how you feel about this piece of legislation. I don't know what works for you and what doesn't work for you. That's my issue that I have with the presentation. Again, I understand the context. I understand the issues that you're raising, and I welcome that input, but I need something concrete that I can put into this piece of legislation. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chairperson, and I think it was a good presentation, but I do agree with him because you need to kind of critique the document and come up with something that is more. But my question is, you mentioned traditional medical doctors and Western medical doctors. How do we distinguish between these two entities? And what role do they play? Because the thing is that it's difficult for me to understand these two, because I think there's only one medical entity then, and there's no traditional medical doctors that I know of. Because the thing is that, do you really follow the same curriculum? Do you what are the ifs and buts and so of these two entities? What makes them medical practitioners? The second one, the traditional medical doctor, sorry.
Okay. Invite Philip. You want to make a point? Okay.
Chairperson, thank you. I want to apologize. I completely understand the Honourable Member's sentiments. In fact, this is a point I was supposed to make at the beginning of my presentation, which is that this is not a comprehensive, detailed critique of the bill, and we want to respectfully request from the chairperson to give us about another week to give you a detailed critique of the bill that incorporates our comments. Our aim with this presentation was to present to you our initial reading of the bill and to present to you our main points from a gender perspective, to initiate discussion from this platform so that we take those notes and we further enrich our critique, which we would, through you, Chairperson, present next week. So that was the main aim, to present these ideas, to have a robust discussion with the Portfolio Committee and other stakeholders, and from there, take our notes, take these discussions, enrich our critique, and bring it to the Portfolio Committee in about a week. So with that, I want to apologize. Coming back to the question regarding the distinctions between what is a medical practitioner and what is a traditional medical practitioner, what we would understand as a traditional medical practitioner is a practitioner who practices, or a surgeon, a traditional surgeon, what is commonly known as a traditional surgeon, the people who do conduct these surgeries on boys in the mountains. That is what we would call a medical practitioner. But on the technicalities of what a medical practitioner and what is vis-a-vis West versus South, or Global South versus Global West, then those are further debates for academics. But if a person conducts a surgery that would also be conducted by a medical practitioner, a Western medical practitioner, then that person has the right to be identified as a medical practitioner, whether they have a certificate or not. In fact, those conceptual debates are mainly what motivates this bill. And these are conceptual debates about who is legitimate and who's not. And can a person without a medical certificate be considered a medical practitioner or not? Or do they need the legitimization of the West to be considered these? Thank you, Chairperson.
Now, I just think that the point that you were raising is very important for us, and I thank you for this. Surely we are going to consider many points that you have raised. Because I think you are raising very important points, because that is the situation in the Val. Families that are headed by women, their children are abducted. But the next door is headed by a man, the child is not abducted. But the women one seems... That's an issue that we are raising, that as we draft our bill also, we should consider, given the fact that anyway, we are told that many families in South Africa are headed by women. I think that's a point, again, that we must consider. At least we are here. Hey, Tube. Umamu sekhaya le Mpumalanga, you know, sekhona. Umamu that are heading families, generally. I think it's very helpful for us, the point that you are raising at a contextual and political level. We should consider some of these issues. You still have time yourself to look at a bill. If you want to go clause by clause, you are free to do so. And then when we meet again, we'll be able to say in terms of Section 1 of this clause, this is a problem. And then we can then consider that and have a discussion about that. In fact, you raise the issue here of other community that almost sometimes got victimized, the LGBTI. Generally, in fact, we never apply our mind generally on this area. But we are raising it. It's very important for us. It's very easy that it's a complex thing. And but as we are saying also that law also should make society. I think, and otherwise you could get a problem on that. And I think we have raised a lot of issues that really even consent. Of course, Malham, there's a section talking about it. But some of the points that are raising there, that the consent can't be yes or no, as we are saying that side. That people should understand what they are agreeing on and what they are not agreeing on. And then otherwise can cause problems, really. I think the point that they are raising, that if I'm a mom, but the issue is secret, and then I give consent on based on what? Because I don't know how this thing happens. That's an issue, I think, that you are raising, that you must take care of those things. And surely, as we drafted the bill, we may consider some of these issues, cultural issues, economic issues, the general issue of power relations between male and female. I think we'll look at it, and we'll look at the bill in that way. And then I think the presentation is assisting us again to bring us back to power relations. We have to attempt our level best to deal with it. And of course, we are free, like an advocate can still come back and fine-tune this law. And when we are taken to court, we seem the advocate, Mohammed, was here. And then he can't be here and endorse it and say that in court we lose it, then we are responsible for it. We can't persecute us, we can't then prosecute us once we have passed it, because we would have been here. And then clause by clause, and the health department will deal with this issue. But a broader issue, I think, for members of parliament is the harmonization of our laws. Because if there's no harmonization of our acts, I think it's a big problem. It's a big problem that I think we should take care of it. That's why we must meet with other departments, find out what is happening, in order for us to tighten it up and show that we had a problem in some of the issues. It's a difficult issue we have to address. And then surely before the end of the year, I think we'll pass the bill. It will not be 100% perfect, I guess. It's always work in progress. But we can't also fold our arms because of sensitivity of culture and people. Because anyway, all cultures are the same, they're equal, must be respected. But at the same time, life of our people comes first.
culture will come, but life of our people comes first. And then we should work out on this. It's very easy for traditional leaders where they are, but also we know that also there are bogus ones. They are just bogus traditional leaders in the world that are there now, but they are not traditional leaders generally. But they are there now. There are a lot of them now in urban areas and urban centers on this. And it's very important, though, because if society is urbanizing so fast, if it's correct anyway, Melham, that you're almost 63% urbanized, the next 20 years, these rural areas generally will be harmless, broadly speaking. And how do you deal with this issue of culture in a multicultural society like in Gauteng? Because it's causing havoc generally. And then I think it's going to cause more harm than good if we don't start doing things, harmonizing it nicely, accept the rural. The rural environment is fine because Andy the Sokoman is somewhere in there, his village is fine. And not in Gauteng. Doesn't work because it's a multicultural society. In fact, we are more cosmopolitan than Johannesburg. And how do you deal with this issue? Because also there are people who are from part of the continent. Surely, I think, one way or another, I advocate. They will also do, the Somalis, they may also be tempted to do their genital mutilation, initiation of females. They will do those things. They wouldn't know because they will do that in the very close corners. But they are practicing. And that's an issue that we should be addressing, generally, as members of parliament. And I accept the point that you are raising, that no, you are going to work on it. Please, everyone must be free, really, to make input. Acting DG, assist us on some of the issues. We don't want to be taken to court by women saying that we undermine them on this. No, we don't want to do so. And then assist us to address some of these issues. The SAPS must assist us to address these issues. NPA also assist us to address this health department. Do this thing correctly. Let us ensure that we come out here with the law of general application, but will assist to eliminate the problem, broadly speaking. And there will be some element here and there that we have to deal with them. I think the age issue, we have to deal with it because it's a problem generally on that. And then it can't be a violation of the law. I would have thought the MPA that anyone who violated the law got arrested. You wouldn't negotiate whether now when in your culture you're allowed. I think there is a complex thing because it must be sensitive also. Because the law also should be broadly accepted by society. Otherwise, there's no law. Then I think that's a dilemma that we are facing, all of us on that. I think it's a good beginning. Members of parliament are going to be enriched by your research and everything. We are still going to be meeting traditional leaders also, engaging with them. I hope that you'll be there one day when we engage them. You'll give us some papers when we argue. I think we must assist us on that. We'll meet with them. We have met with some traditional leaders already for House of Traditional Leaders. They accept the bill in principle. They're very happy with the bill. And then, but the organized one here, who have a house in the National Assembly, they've accepted the bill. And many traditional leaders throughout the country have accepted the bill, generally. Of course, they will have problems with age and other issues there. But it seems generally, in South Africa, everyone is looking upon us to finalize this bill sooner than yesterday. And I think it's an advantage that we mustn't delay it to take charge of the situation. And I think we are ready to do so. Please, those who want to make more contribution, please feel free. Secretary is here, take the note, Mantuli, take a note, and then phone and then call and arrange again to meet with us. We'll be available to engage on some of these issues. And then your attendance really is appreciated, all of you. Let us continue working then together to tighten up the bill. Our intention, of course, is that the bill should be passed by the National Assembly before the end of December. Before you go for holidays, you should do so, because December time, generally, start again the whole issue of initiation. And therefore, we must tighten it up, which has some order in the society on that. And then thank you for presentations. I think we can allow you now to go and do other work. Honourable members,
There is no other item on our agenda except to adjourn the meeting. Thank you very much for contribution. Very helpful. Thank you very much.
No, no, no. It's just the one. Yeah.